CD 13.
To Geradum, Thursday, October 14th, 5:30 a.m. 3 hours later, the sun came up and the plane began its descent. Now it was flying low, passing over green forested islands, fringed in an unearthly pale blue. They saw few roads and few towns, mostly small villages. Ted Bradley looked out the window. "Isn't it beautiful?" he said. "Truly unspoiled paradise. This is what is vanishing in our world." Seated opposite him, Kenner said nothing. He too was staring out the window.
"Don't you think the problem," Bradley said, "is that we have lost contact with nature?"
"No," Kenner said. "I think the problem is I don't see many roads."
"Don't you think," Bradley said, "that's because it's the white man, not the natives, who wants to conquer nature, to beat it into submission?"
"No, I don't think that."
"I do," Bradley said. "I find that people who live closer to the earth, in their villages, surrounded by nature, that those people have a natural ecological sense and a feeling for the fitness of it all."
"Spend a lot of time in villages, Ted," Kenner said.
"As a matter of fact, yes. I shot a picture in Zimbabwe and another one in Botswana. I know what I am talking about."
"Uh-huh. You stayed in villages all that time?"
"No, I stayed in hotels. I had to for insurance. But I had a lot of experiences in villages. There is no question that village life is best and ecologically soundest. Frankly, I think everyone in the world should live that way. And certainly, we should not be encouraging village people to industrialize. That's the problem."
"I see. So you want to stay in a hotel, but you want everybody else to stay in a village?"
"No, you're not hearing."
"Where do you live now, Ted?" Kenner said.
"Sherman Oaks."
"Is that a village?"
"No." "Well, it's a sort of village, I suppose you could say. But I have to be in L.A. for my work," Bradley said. "I don't have a choice."
"Ted, have you ever stayed in a third world village, even for one night?"
Bradley shifted in his seat. "As I said before, I spent a lot of time in the villages while we were shooting. I know what I'm talking about."
"If village life is so great, why do you think people want to leave?"
"They shouldn't leave. That's my point."
"You know better than they do," Kenner said.
Bradley paused, then blurted, "Well, frankly, if you must know, yes, I do know better. I have the benefit of education and broader experience, and I know firsthand the dangers of industrial society and how it is making the whole world sick. So, yes, I think I do know what is best for them. Certainly, I know what is ecologically best for the planet."
"I have a problem," Kenner said, "with other people deciding what is in my best interest when they don't live where I do. When they don't know the local conditions or the local problems I face. When they don't even live in the same country as I do, but they still feel, in some far-off western city, at a desk in some glass skyscraper in Brussels or Berlin or New York, they still feel that they know the solution to all my problems and how I should live my life. I have a problem with that."
"What's your problem?" Bradley said. "I mean, look, you don't seriously believe everyone on the planet should do whatever they want, do you? That would be terrible. These people need help and guidance."
"And you're the one to give it. To these people."
"Okay, so it's not politically correct to talk this way. But do you want all these people to have the same horrific, wasteful living standard that we do in America, and to a lesser extent, Europe?"
"I don't see you giving it up."
"No," Ted said, "but I conserve where I can. I recycle. I support a carbon-neutral lifestyle. The point is, if all these other people industrialize, it will add a terrible, terrible burden of global pollution to the planet. That should not happen."
"I got mine, but you can't have yours."
"It's a question of facing realities," Bradley said.
"Your realities, not theirs."
At that point, San Yong beckoned to Kenner.
"Excuse me," Kenner said, and got up.
Walk away if you want, Bradley said. But you know I speak truth.
He gestured to the flight attendant and held up his glass.
Just one more, sweetie, one more for the road.
San Yong said, The helicopter's not there yet.
What's the matter?
It was coming over from another island. They've closed the airspace because they're worried the rebels have surface-to-air missiles.
Kenner frowned.
How long until we land?
10 minutes.
Keep your fingers crossed.
Abandoned, Ted Bradley slid to the other side of the plane to sit with Peter Evans.
Isn't it gorgeous? He said. Look at that water. Crystalline and pure. And look at the depth of that blue.
Look at those beautiful villages.
In the heart of nature.
Evans was staring out the window but saw only poverty. The villages were clusters of corrugated tin shacks. The roads red mud ruts. The people looked poorly dressed and moved slowly. There was a depressing, disconsolate feeling about them. He imagined sickness, disease, infant death.
Gorgeous, Bradley said. Pristine. I can't wait to get down there. This is as good as a vacation. Did anyone here know the Solomons were so beautiful?
From the front, Jennifer said, Inhabited by headhunters for most of history.
Yes, well, that's all in the past, Bradley said, if it ever existed at all. I mean, all that talk about cannibalism, everybody knows it is not true. I read a book by some professor. There were never any cannibals anywhere in the world. It's all a big myth. Another example of the way the white man demonizes people of color. When Columbus came to the West Indies, he thought they told him there were cannibals there, but it wasn't true. I forget the details. There are no cannibals anywhere. Just a myth. Why are you staring at me that way?
Evans turned. Bradley was talking to San Yong, who was indeed staring.
Well, Bradley said, you're giving me a look. Okay, buddy boy, does that mean you disagree with me?
You are truly a fool, San Yong said in an astonished voice. Have you ever been to Sumatra?
Can't say that I have.
New Guinea?
No. Always wanted to go. Buy some tribal art. Great stuff.
Borneo?
No, but I always wanted to go there, too. The Sultan, what's his name? He did a great job remodeling the Dorchester in London.
Well, San Yong said, if you go to Borneo, you will see the Dayak longhouses, where they still display the skulls of the people they killed.
Oh, that's just tourist attraction stuff.
In New Guinea, they had a disease called kuru, transmitted by eating the brains of their enemies.
That's not true.
Gaidishek won a Nobel Prize for it. They were eating brains, all right.
That was a long time ago.
60s, 70s.
You guys just like to tell scare stories, Bradley said, at the expense of the indigenous people of the world. Come on, face the facts. Human beings are not cannibals.
San Yong blinked. He looked at Kenner.
Kenner shrugged. Absolutely beautiful down there, Bradley said.
He was looking out the window.
And it looks like we're going to land.
Part 7. Resolution. Gareda, Thursday, October 14th, 6:40 a.m. Kotak Field was sticky with humid heat. They walked to the small open shack that was marked Castum in roughly painted letters. To one side of the building was a wooden fence and a gate marked with red handprint and a sign that said, Nougat Rot.
Ah, Nougat Rot, Bradley said. Must be a local tooth problem.
Actually, San Yong said, the red hand means kapu, forbidden. The sign says no got right, which is pidgin for you don't have the permission to pass.
Huh. I see.
Evans found the heat almost unbearable. He was tired after the long plane ride and anxious about what lay ahead of them. Alongside him, Jennifer walked casually, seemingly fresh and energetic. "You're not tired?" Evans said to her. "I slept on the plane." He looked back at Sarah. She, too, seemed to have plenty of energy, striding forward.
"Well, I'm pretty tired."
"You can sleep in the car," Jennifer said. She didn't seem very interested in his condition. He found it a little irritating, and it was certainly debilitatingly hot and humid.
By the time they reached the customs house, Evans's shirt was soaked. His hair was wet. Sweat was dripping off his nose and chin onto the papers he was supposed to fill out. The pen from the ink ran in the puddles of his sweat. He glanced up at the customs officer, a dark, muscular man with curly hair and wearing pressed white trousers and a white shirt. His skin was dry. He looked almost cool. He met Evans's eyes and smiled.
"Oh, wait, men. Dis no time belong, san. You too must hot pila."
Evans nodded. "Yes. True," he said. He had no idea what the man had said. Sanyong translated. "It's not even the hot time of summer, but you're too much hot. You too much hot, yeah?"
He got that right.
"Where'd you learn pidgin?"
"New Guinea. I worked there a year."
"Doing what?" But Sanyong was hurrying on with Kenner, who was waving to a young man who had driven up in a Land Rover. The man jumped out. He was dark, wearing tan shorts and a t-shirt. His shoulders were covered in tattoos. His grin was infectious.
"Hey, John Kenner, who mama's clock?"
He pounded his chest with his fist and hugged Kenner. "He has a happy heart," Sanyong said. "They know each other." The newcomer was introduced all around as Henry, with no other name.
"Henry,"
he said, grinning broadly, pumping their hands. And then he turned to Kenner.
"I understand there is trouble with the helicopter," Kenner said.
"What? No trouble. Me got close too long."
He laughed.
"It's just over there, my friend,"
he said in perfectly accented British English.
"Good," Kenner said. "We were worried."
"Yes, but serious, John. We better hurry up. Me yet harem plenty young palers. Corrosin, paisum, berihu, got plenty masket. No can stab gut, yeah?"
Evans got the impression Henry was speaking pidgin, so the rest of them would not understand.
Kenner said, "I heard that too," he said. "Lots of rebels here. They're mostly young boys, and angry, and well-armed. Figures."
"I worry for the helicopter, me friend."
"Why? Do you know something about the pilot?"
"Yes, I do."
"Why? Who is the pilot?"
Henry giggled and slapped Kenner on the back.
"I am!"
"Well, then, we should go."
They all started down the road, away from the airfield. The jungle rose up on both sides of the road. The air buzzed with the sound of cicadas. Evans looked back with longing at the beautiful white Gulfstream jet, poised on the runway against a blue sky. The pilots in their white shirts and black trousers were checking the wheels. He wondered if he would ever see the airplane again. Kenner was saying,
"And we heard, Henry, some people were killed."
Henry made a face.
"No, just kill, John. Opila, yeah?"
"So we heard."
"Yeah, dis true."
"So it was true. The rebels did it."
Henry nodded.
"Oh, this new chief. Him named Sambuca, like a drink. Don't ask why this name. Him crazy man, John. Long, long man true. Everything back to Opila for dis guy. Old ways are better. All the time, all the time."
"Well, the old ways are better," Ted Bradley said, trudging along behind. "If you ask me." Henry turned.
You got cell phones. You got computers. You got antibiotics, medicines, hospitals. And you say the old ways are better.
Yes, because they are, Bradley said. They were more human. They allowed more of the human texture to life. Believe me, if you ever had a chance to experience these so-called modern miracles yourself, you would know that they are not so great.
I got a degree at the University of Melbourne, Henry said, so I have some familiarity.
Oh, well then, Bradley said, and under his breath he muttered, Might have told me, asshole.
By the way, Henry said, take my advice, don't do that here. Don't talk under your breath.
Why not?
In this country, some peelers think it means you've been possessed by a demon, and they'll get scared. And they might kill you.
I see. Charming.
So in this country, if you have something to say, you speak up.
I'll remember that. Sarah walked alongside Bradley, but she was not listening to the conversation. Henry was a character, caught between worlds, sometimes speaking in an Oxbridge accent, sometimes dropping into pidgin. It didn't bother her. She was looking at the jungle. The air on the road was hot and still, trapped between the huge trees that rose up on both sides of the path. The trees were 40-50 feet high, covered in twisted vines, and at ground level, in the darkness beneath the canopy above, huge ferns grew so thickly they presented an impenetrable barrier, a solid green wall. She thought, you could walk 5 feet into that and get lost forever. You'd never find your way out again. Along the road were the rusted hulks of long-abandoned cars, windshields smashed, chassis crumpled and corroded brown and yellow. As she walked past, she saw ripped upholstery, old dashboards with clocks and speedometers ripped out, leaving gaping holes. They turned right onto a side path, and she saw the helicopter ahead. She gasped. It was beautiful. Painted green with a crisp white stripe, the metal blades and struts gleaming. Everybody commented on it.
Yes, the outside is good, Henry said. But I think the inside, the engine, maybe is not so good.
He wiggled his hand.
So-so.
Great, Bradley said. Speaking for myself, I'd prefer it the other way around. They opened the doors to get in. In the back were stacks of wooden crates and sawdust. They smelled of grease.
I got the supplies you wanted, he said to Kenner.
And enough ammunition?
Oh, yeah. All things you asked for.
Then we can go, Kenner said.
In the back, Sarah buckled her belt. She put on headphones. The engines whined and the blades spun faster. The helicopter shuddered as it started to lift off.
We have too many people, Henry said. So we will have to hope for the best. Cross your fingers.
And giggling maniacally, he lifted off into the blue sky. To Resolution, Thursday, October 14th, 9:02 a.m. The jungle slid beneath them, mile after mile of dense canopy forest. In places, wisps of mist clung to the trees, particularly at the higher altitudes. Sarah was surprised at how mountainous the island was, how rugged the terrain. She saw no roads at all. From time to time, they passed over a small village in a jungle clearing. Otherwise, nothing but miles of trees. Henry was flying due north, intending to drop them off along the coast a few miles west of Resolution Bay.
Charming villages, Ted Bradley said as they flew over another one. What do the people grow here? Nothing. Land's no good here. They work the copper mines, Henry said.
Oh, that's too bad.
Not if you live here. Biggest money they ever saw. People kill to work in the mines. What I mean to say is, they kill. Some murders occur every year.
Bradley was shaking his head. Terrible. Just terrible.
But look down there, he said, pointing. There's a village has actual thatched huts.
Is that the old style? The old way of doing things still kept alive?
No, man,
Henry said.
That's a rebel village. That's new style. Big thatch house. Very impressive. Big house for Chief.
He explained that Sambuca had instructed the people in every village to build these huge three-story structures of thatch, complete with ladders going up to high walkways at the third level. The idea was to give rebels a view over the jungle, so they could see the arrival of Australian troops. But in the old days, Henry said, the people never had such buildings in Gareda. The architecture was low and open, erected mostly to protect against rain and let smoke out. There was no need for high buildings, which were impractical since they could blow down in the next cyclone anyway.
But Sambuca, he wants them now. So he makes the Yang Pilas, the young fellows, build them. There may be 6 or 8 on this island now, in rebel territory.
So we're going over rebel territory now, Bradley said.
So far, so good,
Henry said.
And he giggled again.
Not so long now. We'll see the coast in 4 or 5 minutes. And, oh, damn shit!
What? They were skimming the forest canopy.
I made a big mistake.
What mistake? Bradley said.
Too much long we yes.
You're too far east, Kenner said.
Damn shit! Damn shit! Hang on!
Henry banked the helicopter steeply, but not before they all glimpsed a huge clearing, with 4 of the enormous thatch structures interspersed with the more common houses of wood and corrugated tin. There were 6 trucks clustered in the muddy center of the clearing. Some of the trucks had machine guns mounted on their backs.
What is this? Bradley said, looking down. This is much bigger than the others. This Pavutu, rebel headquarters.
And then the clearing was gone. The helicopter moving swiftly away. Henry was breathing hard. They could hear his breath over the headphones. Kenner said nothing. He was staring intently at Henry.
Well, I think we're all right, Bradley said. It looks like they didn't see us. Oh, yeah, Henry said. Nice wish.
Why? Bradley said. Even if they did see us, what can they do?
They have radios, Henry said. They're not stupid, these Yang Pilas.
What do you mean?
They want this helicopter.
Why? Can they fly it?
All right, yes, because they want me too.
Henry explained that for months now, no helicopters had been allowed on the island. This one had been brought over only because Kenner had pulled some very important strings. But it was specifically not to fall into rebel hands.
Well, they probably think we're going south, Bradley said. I mean, we are, aren't we?
Those boys know better, Henry said. They know.
They know what? Bradley said. Kenner said,
the elf would have had to buy off the rebels in order to land on the island. So the rebels know there's something going on at Resolution Bay. When they saw this helicopter, they knew where it was going.
These boys aren't stupid,
Henry said again. I never said they were, Bradley protested.
Yeah, but you think it. I know you, weight man. This in the back of your tongue. You think it.
I promise you I did not, Bradley said.
Really, I have no such feelings at all. You simply don't understand me.
Yeah, Henry said.
Sarah was sitting in the middle of the second seat, wedged between Ted and Jennifer. Peter and Sanyang were behind in the little back seat with all the boxes. She couldn't really see out the windows, so she had trouble following the discussion. She wasn't sure what it was all about, so she asked Jennifer.
Do you understand what's going on?
Jennifer nodded. As soon as the rebels saw the helicopter, they knew it was going to Resolution. Now, whatever we do, they'll be expecting it to show up in that area. They have radios,
and they're in different groups scattered around. They can keep an eye on us, and they'll be there when we land.
I am very sorry, Henry said. So very sorry.
Never mind, Kenner said. His voice was neutral.
What do we do now?
Henry said. Kenner said,
continue exactly as planned. Go north and put us down on the coast.
There was no mistaking the urgency in his voice. In the back seat, pushed up against San Yang, smelling the grease that coated the machine guns, Peter Evans wondered where this urgency came from. He looked at his watch. It was 9 a.m, which meant that of their original 24 hours, only 20 remained. But this was a small island, and it should allow plenty of time. And then he had a thought.
Wait a minute, he said. What time is it in Los Angeles?
San Yong said,
they're on the other side of the dateline, 27 hours behind. No, I mean elapsed time. Actual time difference. 6 hours.
And you calculated a transit time of what?
13 hours,
San Yong said. I think we made a mistake, Evans said, biting his lip. He wasn't sure how much he should say in front of Henry, and indeed, San Yong was shaking his head, indicating, not now. But they had made a mistake. There was no doubt about it. Assuming that Drake wanted the tidal wave to hit on the last day of the conference, he would surely want it to happen during the morning. That would provide the most visible disaster, and it would allow the whole afternoon for discussion and media interviews afterward. Every television camera in America would be at that conference, talking to the scientists who just happened to be there. It would create a gigantic media event. So, Evans thought, assume the wave was to hit Los Angeles no later than noon tomorrow. Subtract 13 hours for the wave front to cross the Pacific. That meant the wave had to be propagated at 11 p.m. Los Angeles time, which meant that the local time in Gareda would be 5 p.m. 5 p.m. today. They didn't have a day to stop this thing from happening. They had just 8 hours. So that was the reason for Kenner's urgency. That was why he was going ahead with his plan, despite the new problem. He had no choice, and he knew it. He had to land on the coast somewhere very near Resolution. There wasn't enough time to do anything else, even though it was possible they were heading right into a trap. Leaving the forest behind, the helicopter burst out over blue water and turned around, going east. Evan saw a narrow sandy beach with patches of ragged lava rock and mangrove swamps clinging to the water's edge. The helicopter swung low and followed the beach, heading east.
How far from Resolution are we?
Kenner said.
5-6 kilometers, Henry said.
And how far from Pavutu?
Maybe 10 kilometers, on a mud track.
Okay, Kenner said. Let's find a place to put down.
There's a good place I know, maybe 1 kilometer ahead.
Fine, go there.
Evans was thinking, 5 kilometers walking on a beach. That was about 3 miles. Should take them 1.5 hours at most.
They could make it to Resolution Bay well before noon. That would give them...
This the spot,
Henry said. A finger of rugged lava protruded into the ocean. Centuries of waves had smoothed it enough to make a landing possible.
Do it, Kenner said.
The helicopter circled, prepared to descend. Evans was looking out over the dense wall of jungle, where it met the beach. He saw tire tracks in the sand, and a sort of gap in the trees that was probably a road. And those tire tracks.
Say, listen, Evans said. I think...
San Yong jabbed him in the ribs. Hard. Evans grunted.
What is it, Peter?
Kenner said. Nothing.
We're going down, Henry said.
The helicopter descended smoothly, slowly settling onto the lava. Waves lapped at the edge of the rock pad. It was peaceful. Kenner looked out the bubble canopy, scanning the area.
Okay, this good spot?" Henry said.
He seemed nervous now that they were down.
"I don't want to stay long, John, because maybe they come soon."
"Yeah, I understand."
Kenner cracked open the door, then paused.
"So all are okay, John?"
"Just fine, Henry. Very nice spot. Get out and open this back door for us, will you?"
"Yeah, John, I think you can get—"
"Get out!"
And with astonishing swiftness, there was a gun jammed against Henry's head. Henry sputtered and moaned in fear as he fumbled with his door.
"But John, I need to stay inside, John."
"You've been a bad boy, Henry," Kenner said.
"You going to shoot me now, John?"
"Not now," Kenner said,
and abruptly he shoved him out. Henry tumbled onto the sharp lava, howling in pain. Kenner slid over to the pilot seat and shut the door. Immediately, Henry was up, pounding on the canopy, his eyes wild. He was terrified.
"John, John, please, John!"
"Sorry, Henry."
Kenner pushed the stick, and the helicopter began to rise into the air. They had not climbed 20 feet before a dozen men emerged from the jungle all along the beach and began firing at them with rifles. Kenner swung out over the ocean, going north, away from the island. Looking back, they could see Henry standing forlorn on the lava. Some of the men were running toward him. He threw up his hands.
"Little shit," Bradley said. "He would have gotten us killed."
"He may still," Kenner said.
They flew due north, over open water. "So what do we do now?" Sarah said. "Land on the other side of the bay? Walk in from the other side?"
"No," Kenner said. "That's what they'll expect us to do."
"So then?"
"We wait a few minutes and go back to the western side, same as before."
"They won't be expecting that?"
"They may. We'll go to a different spot."
"Farther away from the bay?"
"No, closer."
"Won't Alf hear us?"
"Doesn't matter. By now they know we're coming."
In the back, Sanyong was breaking open the wooden cases and reaching for the guns. He stopped abruptly.
"Bad news," he said.
"What?"
"No guns."
He pushed a lid higher.
"These crates contain ammunition, but no guns."
"That little bastard," Bradley said.
"What do we do now?" Sarah said.
"We go in anyway," Kenner said.
He turned the helicopter and, skimming the water, headed back to Gareda. Resolution, Thursday, October 14th, 9:48 a.m. The western arc of Resolution Bay consisted of a hilly, jungle-covered spine that jutted out into the water, terminating in a rocky point. The other side of the spine flattened into a rocky plateau, some 50 feet above the beach, which curved off to the west. The plateau was protected by high, overhanging trees. That was where the helicopter now stood, covered in a camouflage tarp, overlooking the beach below. Evans glanced back at it, hoping that it would blend into the landscape. But instead, it was only too obviously visible, especially when seen from above. The group was now already 50 feet above it, as they scrambled and clawed up the jungle slope that rose steeply from the beach. The group was now 50 feet above it, as they scrambled and clawed up the jungle slope that rose steeply from the beach. It was surprisingly tough going. They were climbing single file and had to be careful because the ground underfoot was muddy. Bradley had already slipped and slid some 10 yards down. His whole left side was covered in black mud, and Evans could see that there was a fat leech on the back of his neck, but he decided not to point it out just then. No one spoke. The team of six climbed in silence, trying to make as little noise as possible. Despite their best efforts, they were fairly noisy, the undergrowth crackling beneath their feet, small branches snapping as they reached to pull themselves up. Kenner was somewhere farther ahead, leading the way. Evans couldn't see him. Sanyong was bringing up the rear. He had a rifle slung over his shoulder. He had brought it with him and assembled it from a small briefcase in the copter. Kenner carried a pistol. The rest of them were unarmed. The air was still, wet, and stupefyingly hot. The jungle buzzed, an incessant background drone of insects. Halfway up the slope, it began to rain, lightly at first, and then a stupendous tropical downpour. In a moment, they were drenched. Water streamed down the hillside. It was slipperier than ever. Now they were 200 feet above the beach, and the prospect of losing footing was clearly nervous-making. Peter looked up at Sarah, who was just ahead of him. She moved with her usual agility and grace. She seemed to be dancing up the hillside. There were times, he thought, huffing his way along, when he really resented her. And Jennifer, who was ahead of Sarah, was climbing with equal ease. She hardly reached for the tree limbs, though Evans was grabbing for them constantly, feeling panic as his fingers slipped on the fungus-covered bark. Watching Jennifer, he had the sense that she was almost too good at this, too skilled. Going up this treacherous jungle hill, she radiated a kind of indifference, as if it were all to be expected. It was the attitude of an army ranger, or the member of some elite force, tough, experienced, conditioned. Unusual, he thought, for a lawyer. More than unusual. But then, she was Kenner's niece. And farther up was Bradley, with the leech on his neck. He was muttering and cursing and grunting with every step. Finally, Jennifer punched him, then held a finger to her lips. Be quiet. Bradley nodded, and though he clearly disliked taking advice from her, he was silent from then on. At around 300 feet, they felt the stirring of a breeze, and soon after, they climbed onto the crest of the ridge. The foliage was so thick they could not see down into Resolution Bay below, but they could hear the shouts of working men and the intermittent rumble of machinery. Briefly, there was a kind of electronic hum, a sound that started softly, then built quickly until in a few moments it seemed literally to fill the air and to make Evans's eardrums ache. Then the sound was gone. Evans looked at Kenner. Kenner just nodded. Sanyong climbed a tree, scaling it quickly. From his vantage point, he could look down on the valley. He came back down and pointed to a hill leading down to the bay. He shook his head, too steep at this point. He indicated they should circle around and descend on a more gentle slope. So they started out, following the ridge around the bay. Most of the time, they could see nothing but the 6-foot-tall ferns dripping with water. After half an hour, there was a sudden break in the foliage, and they had a panoramic view of Resolution Bay spread out below them. The bay was about a mile wide and had structures set at intervals on the sand. The largest one was to the far right at the eastern edge of the bay. Three others of equal size were arranged at intervals, making a sort of triangle in the western section of the bay. Evans could see there was something funny about the houses, though. Something odd about the wood that was used. He squinted. Sanyong nudged him. He wiggled his hand in the air. Evans looked. Yes, it was true. The wooden structures were moving, fluttering in the air. They were tents. Tents made to look like wooden structures, and pretty good ones, too. It was no wonder they had fooled the aerial survey, Evans thought. As they watched, men emerged from one or another of the tents and shouted to others down the beach. They were speaking English, but it was difficult to make out what they were saying at this distance. Most of it seemed to be technical. Sanyong nudged Evans again. Evans saw him make a kind of pyramid with three fingers, and then he began to wiggle the fingers. So apparently, they were tuning the generators in the tent, or something like that. The others in the group did not seem to be interested in the details. They were breathing hard, catching their breaths in the soft breeze, and staring down at the bay, and probably thinking, as Evans was, that there were a lot of men down there, at least 8 or 10 of them, all in jeans and work shirts.
"Christ, there's a lot of those bastards," Bradley muttered.
Jennifer nudged him hard in the ribs. He mouthed, "Oh, sorry." She shook her head. She mouthed, "You'll get us killed." Bradley made a face. He clearly thought she was being melodramatic. Then, from the jungle below them, they heard a cough. They froze. They waited in silence. They heard the buzz of cicadas, the occasional call of distant birds. It came again. The same soft cough, as if the person was trying not to make noise. Sanyong crouched down, listening hard. The cough came a third time. And then to Evans, there was the strangest sensation of familiarity about it. It reminded him of his grandfather, who had had heart failure when Evans was a kid. His grandfather used to cough like that, in the hospital, weekly, little coughs. Now there was silence. They had not heard the cougher move away. If he had, he was truly noiseless. But the sound stopped. Kenner looked at his watch. They waited 5 minutes. Then he signaled for them to continue moving east, curving around the bay. Just as they were leaving, they heard the cough once more. This time there were 3 in succession. Then nothing. Kenner signaled, "Move out." They had not gone 100 yards when they came upon a path. It was a clear trail, even though the overhanging branches hung low. It must be an animal trail, Evans thought, wondering vaguely what kind of animals they might be. There were probably feral pigs here. There were pigs everywhere. He vaguely remembered stories of people being surprised by pigs, gored by the tusks of an aggressive boar that charged out of the underbrush. The first thing he heard, however, was a mechanical click. He knew instantly what it was, the sound of a gun being cocked. The entire group froze, strung out in single file. Nobody moved. Another click, and another click. Evans looked around quickly. He saw nobody. It seemed they were alone in the jungle. Then he heard a voice.
"Die! No got sook, white men! In die! Stop 'em!"
Evans had no idea what it meant, but the meaning was clear enough to them all. Nobody moved. From the bushes ahead, a young boy emerged. He was wearing boots without socks, green shorts, a Madonna World Tour t-shirt, and a baseball cap that said Perth Glory. A half-smoked cigarette stub hung from his lips. He had an ammunition belt over one shoulder and a machine gun slung over the other shoulder. He was 5 feet tall and could not have been more than 10 or 11. He pointed his gun with casual insolence.
"Okay, white man. You prisoner belong me, savvy? Book 'em, Dano."
And he jerked his thumb, indicating they should move forward.
"Go hit!"
For a moment, they were all too astonished to move. Then, from the jungle on both sides of the path, other boys emerged. Bradley said, "What is this, the Lost Boys?" Without expression, one of the kids slammed the butt of his rifle into Bradley's stomach. Bradley gasped and went down.
"Stop 'em, wait, man, belong, tok tok!"
"Oh, Jesus,"
Bradley said, rolling on the ground. The kid hit him again, this time in the head, and kicked him hard. Bradley moaned.
"And tap, and tap,"
the kid said, gesturing for him to get up. When Bradley didn't respond, the kid kicked him again.
"And tap!"
Sarah went over and helped Bradley to his feet. Bradley was coughing. Sarah was smart enough not to say anything. Oh, nice, Mary, the kid said. Then he pushed her away from Bradley.
And tap!
As they trudged forward, one of the kids went over to Bradley and squeezed the back of his arm, the triceps. He laughed,
Tyus gut!
Evans felt a chill as the words sank in. These boys were speaking a version of English. He could decipher it if he thought about it a little and played the words back in his head. Nice Mary was nice Mary. Maybe Mary was a word for woman. And tap was and up. And taste gut was taste good. They walked single file through the jungle, the kids at their side. Kenner was in the lead, then Ted, who was bleeding from his head, and Sarah and Jennifer, then Evans. Evans glanced over his shoulder. Sanyong was not behind him. All he saw was another ragged kid with a rifle.
Antap! Antap!
The kid made a threatening gesture with his rifle. Evans turned and hurried forward. There was something chilling about being herded by children, except these weren't children. He was only too aware of the cold look in their eyes. They had seen a lot in their lives. They lived in another world. It was not Evans's world. But he was now in theirs. Up ahead, he saw a pair of jeeps at the side of a muddy road. He looked at his watch. It was 10 o'clock. 7 hours to go. But somehow it didn't seem important anymore. The kids pushed them into the jeeps, and then they drove off down a muddy track into the dark and trackless interior of the jungle. Bavutu, Thursday, October 14th, 11:02 a.m. There were times, Sarah thought, when she really did not want to be a woman. That was how she felt as she was driven into the muddy village of Bavutu, the rebel stronghold, in the back of an open jeep. The village seemed to be populated almost entirely by men who came yelling into the clearing to see who had arrived. But there were women, too, including older women who stared at her height and her hair and then came up and poked at her, as if she might not be real. Jennifer, who was shorter and darker, stood beside her and attracted no attention at all. Nevertheless, they were herded together into one of the huge thatch houses. Inside the house was a large open space, a kind of central room, 3 stories high. There was a ladder made of wood leading up to a series of landings, going all the way to the top, where there was a kind of catwalk and a viewing area. In the center of the room was a fire, and at the fire sat a heavy-set man with pale skin and a dark beard. He wore sunglasses and had a sort of beret with the Jamaican flag on it. This, it seemed, was Sambuca. They were shoved in front of him, and he leered at them. But it was clear to Sarah, she had an instinct for these things, that he was not interested in them. He was interested in Ted and in Peter. Kenner he inspected briefly, then looked away.
Kill him!
They pushed Kenner out the door, poking him with the butts of their rifles. They were clearly excited at the prospect of executing him.
No, nah!
Sambuca said in a growl.
Be hang!
It took Sarah a moment to translate in her head. Not now, behind. Which must mean later on, she thought. So Kenner had a reprieve, at least for a while. Sambuca turned and stared at the others in the room.
Mabbies,
he said, with a dismissive wave.
Go up a Mary behind.
Sarah had the distinct impression, from the grins on the faces of the boys, that they were being given the freedom to do with the 2 women what they wanted. Go up 'em. She and Jennifer were led off to a back room. Sarah remained calm. Of course, she knew things were bad, but they were not bad yet. She was noticing that Jennifer did not appear to be shaken in the least. She had the same flat, uninterested expression that she might have if she was walking toward a company cocktail party. The boys took the two women into a thatched room at the back of the larger building. There were two posts, sunk in the earthen floor. One of the kids took out a pair of handcuffs and cuffed Jennifer to one post, her hands behind her back. Then he cuffed Sarah to the other post in the same way. Then another kid reached up and squeezed Sarah's tit, smiled knowingly, and walked out of the room. "Charming," Jennifer said when they were alone. "You all right?"
"So far, yes."
There were drums starting to beat from somewhere outside, in the courtyard between the thatch buildings.
"Good," Jennifer said. "It's not over yet." "San Yong is
right, he is.
But we came a long way in the jeeps."
"Yes, at least 2 or 3 miles. I tried to see the odometer, but it was spattered with mud. But on foot, even running, it'll take him a while."
"He had a rifle."
"Yes."
"Can you get free?"
Jennifer shook her head.
"It's too tight."
Through the open door, they saw Bradley and Evans being led away to another room. They glimpsed the two men only for a moment. Not long after, Kenner followed. He glanced into their room, giving what seemed to Sarah a meaningful look. But she couldn't be sure. Jennifer sat down on the bare earth, leaning back against the pole. She said,
"Might as well sit down. It could be a long night."
Sarah sat down too. A moment later, a young boy looked in and saw that they were sitting. He came into the room, looked at their handcuffs, and then walked out again. Outside, the drums were louder. People must have been starting to gather because the women could hear shouts and murmurs.
"Going to be a ceremony," Jennifer said. "And I'm afraid I know what it is."
In the next room, Evans and Kenner were also handcuffed around two posts. Because there was not a third post, Ted Bradley was handcuffed and left seated on the ground. His head was no longer bleeding, but he had a huge bruise over his left eye, and he looked distinctly frightened. But his eyelids were drooping, as if he might fall asleep.
"What's your impression of village life so far, Ted?" Kenner said. "Still think it's the best way to live?"
"This isn't village life. This is savagery."
"It's all part of it."
"No, it's not. These young kids, that fat, creepy guy, this is lunacy. This is everything gone wrong."
"You just don't get it, do you?" Kenner said. "You think civilization is some horrible, polluting human invention that separates us from the state of nature. But civilization doesn't separate us from nature, Ted. Civilization protects us from nature. Because what you see right now, all around you, this is nature."
"Oh, no, no, no. Humans are kind. Cooperative."
"Horseshit, Ted.
There are genes for altruism."
"Wishful thinking, Ted."
"All cruelty springs from weakness."
"Some people like cruelty, Ted."
"Leave him alone," Evans said.
"Why should I? Come on, Ted. Aren't you going to answer me?"
"Oh, fuck you,"
Ted said.
"Maybe we're all going to get killed here by these juvenile delinquent creeps, but I want you to know, if it's the last fucking thing I say in my life, that you are a major and unrelenting asshole, Kenner. You bring out the worst in everybody. You're a pessimist. You're an obstructionist. You're against all progress, against everything that is good and noble. You are a right-wing pig in whatever the fuck you're wearing. Whatever those clothes are. Where's your gun?"
"I dropped it."
"Where?"
"Back in the jungle."
"You think San Yong has it?"
"I hope so."
"Is he coming to get us?"
Kenner shook his head.
"He's doing the job we came to do."
"You mean he's going to the bay?"
"Yes."
"So nobody is coming to get us?"
No, Ted. Nobody.
We're fucked, he said. We're fucking fucked. I can't believe it.
And he started to cry. Two boys entered the room, carrying two heavy hemp ropes. They attached one rope to each of Bradley's wrists, tying them firmly. Then they walked out again. The drums beat louder. Out in the center of the village, people took up a rhythmic chant. Jennifer said, "Can you see out the door from where you are?" "Yes." "Keep an eye out. Tell me if someone is coming." "All right," Sarah said. She glanced back and saw that Jennifer had arched her back and was gripping the pole between her hands. She had also bent her legs so her soles touched the wood and proceeded to shimmy up the pole at a remarkable speed like an acrobat. She got to the top, raised her cuffed hands clear of the top of the pole, and then jumped lightly to the ground. "Anybody?" she said. "No. How'd you learn to do that? Keep looking out the door." Jennifer slid back against her pole again, as if she were still handcuffed to it. "Anybody yet?" "No, not yet." Jennifer sighed. "We need one of those kids to come in," she said. "Soon." Outside, Sambuca was giving a speech, screaming brief phrases that were each answered by a shout from the crowd. Their leader was building them up, working them into a frenzy. Even in Ted's room, they could feel it building. Bradley was curled in fetal position, crying softly. Two men came in, much older than the boys. They unlocked his handcuffs. They lifted him to his feet. Each man took a rope. Together, they led him outside. A moment later, the crowd roared. Pavutu, Thursday, October 14th, 12:02 p.m.
"Hey, cutie pie," Jennifer said, when a boy stuck his head in the door. She grinned. "You like what you see, cutie pie?"
She shifted her pelvis suggestively. The boy looked suspicious at first, but he came deeper into the room. He was older than the others, maybe 14 or 15, and he was bigger. He was carrying a rifle and wore a knife on his belt.
"You want to have some fun?"
"Want to let me go?" Jennifer said, smiling with a little pout.
"You understand me? My arms hurt, baby. Want to have fun?"
He gave a laugh, a sort of gurgle from deep in his throat. He moved toward her and pushed her legs open, then crouched down in front of her.
"Oh, let me go first, please."
"No, Mary," he said, laughing and shaking his head.
He knew he could have her while she remained cuffed to the pole. He was kneeling between her legs, fumbling with his shorts. But it was clumsy holding the gun, so he set the gun down. What happened next was very fast. Jennifer arched her back and kicked her legs up, clipping the kid under the chin, snapping his head back. She continued the motion, crunching into a ball, swinging her arms under her hips and butt, and then up her legs, so now her hands were in front of her instead of behind. As the kid staggered to his feet, she slammed him in the side of the head with both hands. He went down to his knees. She dove on him, knocking him over, and pounded his head into the ground. Then she pulled the knife off his belt and cut his throat. She sat on his body while he shivered and spasmed and the blood poured from his throat and onto the bare earth. It seemed to take a long time. When the body was finally motionless, she got off him and riffled through his pockets. Sarah watched the whole thing, her mouth open.
"Damn it," Jennifer said. "Damn it! What's the matter? He doesn't have the key."
She rolled the body over, grunting with the effort. She got blood on her arms from the flowing throat. She paid no attention to it.
"Where are the damn keys?"
"Maybe the other kid has it."
"Which one cuffed us?" I don't remember, Sarah said. I was confused.
She was staring at the body, looking at all the blood. Hey, Jennifer said, get over it. You know what these guys are going to do. They're going to beat us up, gangbang us, and then kill us. Fuck 'em. We kill as many as we can, and we try to get out of here alive. But I need the damn key.
Sarah struggled to her feet.
Good idea, Jennifer said. She came over and crouched down in front of Sarah. What? Stand on my back and shimmy up. Get yourself off the pole and hurry.
Outside, the crowd was screaming and roaring, a constant and ugly sound.
Ted Bradley blinked in the bright sunlight. He was disoriented by pain and fear, and by the sight that greeted his eyes. Two lines of old women, forming a corridor for him to walk down, all applauding him wildly. In fact, beyond the old women was a sea of faces, dark-skinned men and young girls, and kids hardly waist-high. They were all yelling and cheering, dozens of people crowded together. They were cheering him. Despite himself, Ted smiled. It was a weak smile, sort of a half-smile, because he was tired and hurt. But he knew from experience that it would convey just the right hint of subtle pleasure at their response. As he was carried forward by the two men, he nodded and smiled. He allowed his smile to become broader. At the far end of the women was Sambuca himself. But he, too, was applauding wildly, his hands high in the air, a broad smile on his face. Ted didn't know what was happening here, but obviously he had misunderstood the meaning of the whole thing. Either that, or they had figured out who he was and now thought better of their original plan. It wouldn't be the first time. The women were cheering so loudly as he was carried forward, their mouths gaping with excitement, that he tried to shake off the men who were holding him. He tried to walk unaided. And he did. But now that he was closer, he noticed that the applauding women had heavy sticks resting against their hips as they cheered. Some had baseball bats, and some links of metal pipe. And as he came closer, they continued to shout. But they picked up their bats and sticks and began to strike him. Heavy blows on the face and shoulders and body. The pain was instant and incredible, and he sank down to the ground. But immediately the men with the ropes hauled him up again and dragged him, while the women beat him and screamed and beat him. And the pain streaked through his body, and he felt a vague detachment, an emptiness. But still the blows came, merciless, again and again. And finally, barely conscious, he came to the end of the line of women and saw a pair of poles. The men quickly tied his arms to the two poles in a way that kept him upright. And now the crowd fell silent. His head was bowed. He saw blood dripping from his head onto the ground. And he saw two naked feet appear in his line of vision. And the blood spattered on the feet. And someone lifted his head. It was Sambuca, though Bradley could barely focus on his face. The world was gray and faint. But he saw that Sambuca was grinning at him, revealing a row of yellow-pointed teeth. And then Sambuca held up a knife so Ted could see it, and smiled again, and with two fingers grabbed the flesh of Ted's cheek and sliced it off with the knife. There was no pain. Surprisingly, no pain. But it made him dizzy to see Sambuca hold up the bloody chunk of his cheek and, grinning, open his mouth and take a bite. The blood ran down Sambuca's chin as he chewed, grinning all the while. Bradley's head was spinning now. He was nauseated and terrified and revolted, and he felt a pain at his chest. He looked down to see a young boy of 8 or 9 cutting flesh from his underarm with a pocket knife. And a woman raced forward, screaming for the others to get out of the way, and she hacked a slice from the back of his forearm. And then the whole crowd was upon him, and the knives were everywhere, and they were cutting and yelling and cutting and yelling, and he saw one knife move toward his eyes and felt his trousers tugged down, and he knew nothing more.
Bavutu, Thursday, October 14th, 12:22 p.m. Evans listened to the crowd cheering and yelling. Somehow he knew what was happening. He looked at Kenner, but Kenner just shook his head. There was nothing to do. No help was coming. There was no way out. The door opened, and 2 boys appeared. They carried 2 heavy hemp ropes, now visibly soaked in blood. They walked up to Evans and carefully knotted the ropes to his hands. Evans felt his heart start to pound. The boys finished and left the room. Outside, the crowd was roaring.
"Don't worry," Kenner said. "They'll let you wait a while. There's still hope."
"Hope for what?"
Evans said in a burst of anger. Kenner shook his head.
"Just hope."
Jennifer was waiting for the next kid to come in the room. He did finally, and took one look at the fallen boy and began to bolt, but Jennifer had her arms around his neck. She yanked him back into the room with her hands over his mouth so he couldn't scream, and made a sudden quick twist and let him fall to the ground. He wasn't dead, but he would be there a while. But in that moment when she had looked outside, she had seen the keys. They were out in the thatch passageway, on a bench across the hall. There were 2 guns in the room now, but there was no point in firing them. They would just bring everybody on them. Jennifer didn't want to look outside again. She heard murmuring voices. She couldn't be sure whether they were coming from the next room or from the hallway. She couldn't make a mistake. She leaned back against the wall by the door and moaned. Softly at first, then louder, because the crowd was still very noisy. She moaned and moaned. Nobody came. Did she dare to look out? She took a breath and waited.
End of CD 13.